Coming up on Digital Music Trends 180 on the 23rd of April 2014, Beats Music allows in-app subscriptions, Shazam said to be partnering with Apple for iOS 8, a look at Record Store Day 2014 with UK coordinator Spencer Hickman, Pandora's pre-1972 headache, Samsung Milk going premium, Rock in Rio's Vegas plans, Sony in India and the Beat Robo's fundraise. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Lunelli and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And the DMT is available as an audio and a video show on a variety of channels, including the iTunes Store, most podcatching apps, including Downcast, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, and many more. And if you'd like to receive a weekly mail out on the lowdown on the latest shows, you can sign up on bit.ly/DMTlist, or you can get in touch via Twitter on @DigiMusicTrends or email contact@DigitalMusicTrends.com. And this week it's a real pleasure to welcome two London-based guests, starting with Stuart Dredge, journalist covering music technology as Music Ally, but also apps and technology at large at The Guardian. So hi Stuart, and thanks for joining us. How's it going?
Good, thanks. Hello.
It's great to have you. And it's also a real pleasure to welcome back to the show Stephen O'Reilly, the CMO at Shuffler FM. So hi Stephen, and how's it going?
Hi Andrea, things are good.
Excellent. It's great to have you. And hopefully we're going to have a guest popping up in a few minutes to chat about one of the stories. But this week, I'd like to open by talking about Beats Music. And so there were a couple of different things that we can discuss around Beats Music this week. But I'd like to start with sort of the factual side of things, which is always a good start, I think, you know, the actual story that really happened. And that is the fact that Beats Music has bitten the Apple bullet and decided to add in-app purchase to its offering on the iOS app, which remains at $9.99 a month in the US. So that means that Beats Music is giving essentially 30% of their revenue to Apple. The move was apparently spurred by the fact that Beats Music has a heavy iOS user base, and they had to go out of their way to make sure that the iOS users could upgrade super easily, and try and capitalize on that support from the Apple ecosystem. So, Stuart, do you think this is a kind of a weird move, considering that most other companies that are working in this field and that have added in-app purchase for their streaming service have actually charged more to consumers to be able to compensate for that loss?
Yeah, I think it's a very bold move from Beats, because I think if you're a streaming music company, you pay 70% of your revenues out to publishers and labels, 30% is your margin spent on everything else, and they're giving that all up to Apple. So I'd be interested to see if it's an opening gambit and they'll raise the prices later, or if they're really intending to be very, very aggressive and go, because I think RDO is, what, $14, $15 in the States?
Right.
And these over here, so... But yeah, I mean, it's very, for users, it's good, I think. Subscribing, that whole moment where you have, right, I can't have it for free anymore, I have to subscribe.
Yeah.
Can I do it with tapping a button here? It makes sense. I think Spotify is the only company not really doing that now and holding out and saying we have to have credit card details.
Yeah.
So yeah, it makes sense. But the margins must be wafer thin.
Stephen, do you think that, for example, Bloom FM here in the UK, they do charge more as well. And do you think that... it's just a question of volume, and if they can get enough volume, then they can make up for it that way? Or is it a dangerous move to decide to lose 30% of your margin at this point?
I think it's all about volume.
Yeah.
It's all about getting those users in the door first and getting folks signed on long term. And like Beats are in the business of acquiring users right now via whatever distribution deals they can do. And if you can get... if you can make it easy for people to sign in, just click buy on iTunes on their iPhone, one click, that's the way to do it, for the moment.
Yeah.
Obviously, Spotify doing it a different way. Bloom FM, I was looking before I came online today, £14 for the top tier.
Yeah.
Bloom FM package here in the UK, if you do it via iTunes, £10 if you do it via their website, so... it's brave from Beats, but they need to do it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And from the non-factual side of things, which is more on the speculation front, there was a report from Billboard talking about the fact that Beats Music was off to a bit of a rocky start, which, in their... in their report, they say that, you know, the numbers are not where they're supposed to be given the amount of money they've spent on marketing so far, including the Super Bowl advert that, of course, we talked about at length when it came out in February. And, you know, there's a bit of concern around, you know, of course, user adoption that is not coming from the AT&T side of things. And also, the report was also quoting the fact that the company is already trying to find a new round of funding, although Beats Music actually denied that later that day. So, Stephen, do you think that it's too early from a product perspective to call it, you know, just 3 months in? I think, you know, we need to give them a bit more of a runway to decide whether the service is working or not, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure when Beats have numbers to release, you know, they won't be, they'll be pretty quick about getting those numbers out there. You know, it's important that they're successful. I think, you know, there's, you know, for any stream, you know, streaming is still not mainstream, people are saying. So, and the labels want Beats to succeed. So yeah, you know, let's give them some time.
Yeah, give some time to talk to sort of sort out the kinks, and I'm sure that maybe when they do tie up the service with their headphones, that might be a big boost to the service overall as well. And
yeah, I think they could. I'm surprised that they haven't yet done that, but maybe it's still early in the cycle. You know, like yeah. I presume they're working on that on some kind of distribution opportunities with the headphones and the AT&T deal, and then maybe they're figuring out international as well.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the toughest part, isn't it? Trying to figure out the licensing side of things for international is going to be a big headache for them as well. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just a bit weird, like, at the moment we're just going on rumors. So, Stuart, how do you feel about, there's a lot of articles these days that are, you know, a few writers that I trust wholeheartedly, where, you know, you're talking about, you know, rumors or people familiar with the subject, but there, you know, there's a lot of speculation also around services. So how do you handle that as a journalist? So when it comes to, like, trying to decide whether that's a source worth mentioning, if it's coming from a third party and you can't really confirm it yourself?
Yeah, it's hard because, I mean, leaks are great fun as journalists, you know, figures coming out. If you've got them written down on paper, like we did some stories in the past about Spotify, for example, where we had the figures from a label contact.
Yeah.
So we had them in black and white and we knew they were true, so we could go with it. And here, yeah, I mean, a lot of it is just ask the question of who is leaking and why, and what is their kind of incentive and what they're doing. So here it's clearly labels saying we think we'd like Beats to be doing something different.
Yeah.
So in a way that the Billboard piece, it felt like a label saying we'd like to nudge them into a slightly different strategy of doing more free stuff, I think was the. So yeah, so it's often instructive as much about the people leaking as it is about the service. Yeah. Trying to gauge how labels see Beats, how they'd like it to evolve.
And seeing how the information flows on that front as well.
Because,
I mean, I hadn't even realized, because I haven't really tried Beats extensively being in the UK, that there is a free component to the service that is not really advertised, but apparently they've boosted the number of tracks that is on that portion, which is an internet radio type play. So apparently after the 7 days of trial expire, you can still access this sort of internet radio type service from Beats, which I didn't know anything about. So I don't know if you guys had any more information on that.
No,
I didn't hear about it myself, so yes, news to me.
Mm. And they've been very big, haven't they? Like Ian Rogers, the boss, has been very big on, like, you pay for music, music has a value, we don't think we should give it to you free.
Exactly.
And we're not building that kind of business. And so that's the other thing, is it's a dynamic here of he's been very clear about how he sees Beats Music operating.
Yeah.
And it's going to be not ad-funded and free, it's going to be a premium service.
Yeah.
And this article seemed to have rights holders saying we'd like it to have more free stuff, which would be a very big reversal to make, change the kind of nature of the business, make it more like Spotify and Deezer. And in a way, I'd like Stephen was saying, I want to see it after a year and how it's done, so we can understand if you can have success with a premium only streaming service with limited trial.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because then we've got, it's different to the others in that respect. Or Rhapsody, I think, is the most close we have, I suppose. So yeah, I mean, I think, again, we were talking Musical.ly about this, about how I think in America there's a big thing where you have a look at the first 100 days of anything and say, how's it gone? Which I think is like a JFK thing, isn't it? I think the first 100 days of the presidency.
Yeah.
But with a streaming service, that's far too short. You need like a year to see how it's caught on and what conversion rates are and so on.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I mean, most people are still converting from sort of the free trial to the paid trial to the paid service that were on the AT&T trials early on. So I think that's really going to drive some of that too, if people start talking about it, or, you know, they decide to actually spend money on the service on AT&T, and they might talk about it with their friends, for example. So yeah, we're just going to have to wait and see what happens on that front too. You know, viral marketing is one of the most important things for these services, and making sure the users are happy and that they advertise the service with their friends. So we're going to have to see what happens. And one of the most interesting stories that came up this week, as well as the Beats one, is Shazam. So Shazam is reportedly talking with Apple about a tight integration of the service into iOS 8, which is could be pretty cool. You know, Apple is trying to find ways to increase the number of downloads, you know, which are stalling or on the decline. And iTunes Radio has not proven to be a hugely successful service for conversion from the streaming side to the buying of tracks. And so Shazam could be that stopgap that helps iOS increase the number of people that want to buy tracks by recognizing them on the fly. So, you know, Stuart, you wrote a piece actually that, you know, where in the headlines you actually wondered should on Music Ally should Apple buy Shazam, which is an interesting point. And so, you know, how do you see this partnership going, and is Apple just holding back a little bit too much these days on acquisitions? I mean, we've seen Waze slip through their hands, you know, right when they were in a desperate need for better data on maps, and you know, it just seems like they should be a little bit bolder in their acquisition strategy, and they're still going, you know, for smaller companies and, you know, strategic acquisitions, but they haven't done a splashy acquisition in quite some time.
Yeah, and it's kind of their start. I think they always have the same official quote, which is like, we buy small companies from time to time, we're not going to tell you what we're doing with them. Yeah. Stop asking us nosy questions. But I think it'd be a fascinating deal, whether it's a partnership or whether they were to buy Shazam. And there's no, it's literally me saying they maybe should buy it. There's no indication that they are considering that.
Oh, no, exactly, yeah.
But I think Shazam, we tend to look at it as a prism of music identification. You know, it's about Shazam in iOS so they can identify tunes and buy them. But actually what they're getting is something quite bigger if they do this, which is the auto Shazam feature, where Shazam sits there and listens to everything you listen to. So it knows what TV shows you've watched. It knows what music you listen to. Yeah. It's basically this record of your media habits. And if that was built into iOS, if your iPhone is sitting there doing that all the time for you, and Apple then has that data, I mean, that's really valuable for Apple to have the data on what I've watched on TV,
yeah,
to have the data on what I've listened to, have data on what ads I've heard and seen on TV. So I think it's about that. It's about that data of understanding your media usage.
Yeah.
And music can benefit from that, and it maybe will be about making it easy to buy iTunes songs that you've heard in the real world.
Yeah.
But I think it's more about getting, I think Apple traditionally, Apple knows what I've bought from iTunes over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
It doesn't know what I've listened to necessarily, especially as I've moved to streaming services. And this for Apple is a way of getting that data again. People who've maybe dropped out of its iTunes ecosystem a bit. I mean, I've bought so many apps, it knows lots about me on that side, but it doesn't know much about my music habits,
yeah,
or
absolutely.
My TV watching habits.
Which is crazy, considering that music is where they started from. So they definitely missed a bit of a trick there when it came to data gathering. But then again, Apple have always been, we were talking last week about how Apple have always been very pro-privacy, and they haven't really mined users as much as, you know, anywhere near as much as Google, for example. And so whether that strategy changes or not, that's going to be a question mark. And so, Stephen, for you, Shazam, an important company for the music ecosystem. We're seeing sort of conflicting reporting reports on that front. You know, do you believe Shazam is, you know, going to be relevant in the next few years, and this Apple tie-up could be an important one for them?
Yeah, I think it makes sense to bake it into iOS, like like Twitter and Facebook are baked into the product right now. I guess Shazam's a big company now, so Apple probably you know, Apple have the money, but if you want to hire all of the hundreds of Shazam staff as well, so, you know, Shazam is huge on both platforms. There's probably more users on Android than there is on iOS, so it could be a little bit awkward if you look at it from that point of view. I'd love to see it baked into the product, because sometimes, you know, like, I know that they're working hard on TV, and I'm looking at some ads at times, and, you know, like, there's a call to action for a Shazam-enabled ad, and by the time you get your phone out and Shazam the track, you know, it takes 10 to 15 seconds, and ad spots are like 15 seconds to 30 seconds. So, like, I always struggle sometimes to actually Shazam something when there is a call to action. So it does make sense to bake it into iPhone.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm excited also, you know, as we were saying about the advertising potential for this, when you combine it with stuff like iBeacons and you know, you can get some pretty powerful you know, recommendations and pretty powerful sets of data as to where people are, what they're listening to, what activity they're engaged in, and sort of tie that all together. You know, do you think that Apple is going to start leveraging this data? It feels like they kind of have to in order to start competing with some of their competitors on the marketplace right now. And if they lag behind, they might just miss a boat there.
Yeah, so I think context is a very important thing around all of the content. Yeah. So, you know, like Apple know where you are, you know, they can tell where you are, but you know, if they can tie that to an episode of a X Factor or something, I think in the US, they, you know, X Factor and Shazam worked together in the United States. I'd love to see more of that kind of happen in Europe and in the UK. But we're kind of moving into a context-driven world now, you know, so it'd be nice to be able to tie all of those things together and, yeah,
in a nice package.
Yes.
I went to a TV show recently, a TV industry show, and they were talking about Google and the X Factor in the US, or Google and American Idol, I think it was.
Yeah.
And Google, if you search for an American Idol contestant, Google would say, hey, do you want to vote in this week's American Idol? Vote here. And I think they said about half their votes were coming from Google then. And again, it was context. Like, Google knows you're searching for someone who's a contestant in this series. So it says, well, why not vote? I mean, Apple could do that on your phone.
Yeah.
It could say, right, I know you're listening to this or you're doing this, so why not?
Yeah, and also, if you think about Shazam, you know, and you use the context thing again, you know, when you Shazam something, you know, in the latest version, there's lots of different drop-down options. And, you know, when you Shazam a track, by the way, you can listen on audio, sign up for an account. But there's also things like the next show, you know, so the context is like, why are people Shazamming this track, you know? And like, here's, you know, so some of the other things that Shazam could do would be to put the context around that, like, people are Shazamming this now because, you know, so I think there's a bit more work to be done there.
Yeah.
But I think I think in the next year or hopefully sooner, we'll see joining of those things together.
Be
pretty cool.
Yeah,
I mean, Shazam have already done a little bit of stuff, haven't they? I think at Christmas, they've got a new feature where if you're an artist, you can now reach out to people who've tagged you in the past from Shazam, and you can send them a message saying, hi, I've got a new thing out.
Yeah.
I think they did it with you. And you think about Apple then, think about, okay, well, everyone who's ever tagged Beyonce using Shazam, if Apple could then push them a thing saying she's got a new thing on the apps in the iTunes store, a new album, surprise, get it here. Or if it knows you've watched every episode of the last Game of Thrones series, Apple could push notify you saying, by the way, we've got a new episode in iTunes right now. Click here to get it. Like, a lot of that, everyone's doing the same thing. I think that Spotify is doing that. We know what you've listened to, so we think you'd like this. And by the way, here's a new album from that band you love. And Apple's ability to do that depends on it knowing what you've been doing and listening to and watching. So that's where Shazam would be a really good fit, I think, for the company.
Absolutely.
Either as a partner or as a buy.
Absolutely. And moving on from the digital side of things to the physical side of things, it's a real pleasure to welcome Spencer Hickman, the founder of Death Waltz Records and also the UK coordinator for Record Store Day. So hi, Spencer, and thanks for joining us. How's it going?
No problem. Yeah, all good.
It's great to have you. And so I want to talk about Record Store Day. Of course, it happened on Saturday, and it was a bigger deal than ever. It's grown so much. So can you give us a few of the latest numbers around Record Store Day this year?
Well, we haven't had any figures in yet.
All right.
I mean, we had more stores than ever this year, so we had 240 stores participate.
Wow.
From the stores that I've spoken to, they had much busier years through the till. Like, this year was a lot busier through the till than it has been before.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's grown every year, so I mean, we're assuming that this year has been bigger than ever.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And so, you know, I was at Rough Trade East at 10:30, 11 a.m, and the queue was just insane. It was about 200 meters queue, and I've spoken to people that were there, you know, at 7 a.m. and they still had to queue like an hour to get in. So, in that sense, it was pretty successful. But you know, I want to talk about sort of the evolution of Record Store Day with you as well, and sort of ask you a little bit about what your thoughts are for the evolution of the event, because we've seen a few articles in the press that you know are questioning issues that are coming up to do with the production line of LPs and independent labels having a harder time finding space at the presses and all that kind of thing. So what's your view on the day, and how can it be managed so that everybody is kind of happy with the way they are, the kind of access facilities around the pressing of vinyl?
The simple fact of the matter is, when you've got a day that's worldwide and it's a worldwide celebration of record stores, you're never going to please everybody.
Yeah.
It's an impossible task. What we do every year is we have a meeting in May where we sort of analyse the things that were good and the complaints that we've had. And, you know, I do take, whenever a label says to me, we can't get our records pressed, then it's a worry. I mean, the problem you have is that there are no new manufacturing pressing being made.
Yeah.
So that's, you just, if GZ in Prague just found six machines and they hope to be able to get three of them working within the next 6 months. So as vinyl grows, it becomes a problem. And yeah, somewhere like GZ at the moment is running at 24 hours a day. They're running at capacity as it is. I mean, all we can do is sort of look at the problems we've had this year and sort of try and give everyone better time frames and kind of just, yeah, we have to talk about it worldwide and figure out how, you know, what we can do about it. But I mean, it's difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. Steven, what was the feedback you heard from Record Store Day this year?
I'm a huge fan of Record Store Day, and it's like one of the great days of the year for me in the music industry. It's like you meet so many people in the stores, and it's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, I've seen a lot of the, not a lot, but there were some like negative articles, but that's because the Record Store Day has become so successful. I think it was Paul Weller was complaining about, you know, people were touting his record online same day, you know, because of the notion of exclusivity and short run discs. So that stuff's going to happen. I'd love to see, you know, I hate seeing people charging like crazy money for records that they bought the same day. It's disappointing, but it's because it's successful. But I'm a massive fan, and I think the guys have done a great job. But I'd love to see it. It's a hard thing to do, I guess, and the guys probably have this conversation all the time, is like make a Record Store Day more than just one day, or, you know, how do you make it into a week-long thing, or,
yeah,
you know, it's easier said than done.
Absolutely, yeah. Stuart, on your end, what was the feedback that you had about or that you heard?
Yeah, good, I think. It's just exciting to be excited about music and physical music and meeting. I mean, it's funny because I write about digital music all the time, and my book is focused on writing about stuff like community online and social networks, and then writing about curation on the other, the big theme of digital music curation. And you think, well, community and creation is what the best record stores are about.
Yeah.
It's about people getting together and recording. And I think, I live in Bishop Stortford in Hertfordshire, and we used to have a record shop, and now we don't. We have basically Sainsbury's, Smith's, and that's it. But then recently we've had there's a pub, a great blues pub, and they've set up like a vinyl record store essentially in the back room of a pub. So you come and you get drinks, and then you buy records and you talk to people about it.
That's awesome.
And that, again, it's coming back, this idea of community around buying music, not just a store where you pick up the latest chart CD. So I think it's a wonderful thing. Like I was actually this weekend kind of wandering out, and it gives you, it kind of reminds people, I think, of get down to the store, find out what's good, and then keep coming back after the day's over. So, yeah, you know, it's a marvelous thing, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And Spencer, on your front, you know, all the releases that were out, what were the ones that excited you personally that came out over the 600 plus?
Hard to choose. The things that I bought, I picked up the Ghostbusters 10-inch.
Awesome.
Just because it glows in the dark. But I'm going to listen to it. It just looks amazing.
Nice.
I got the Life Without Buildings record. I got the Joy Division record. Adam and the Ants reissue.
Very cool. Nice.
Yeah.
Supersonic. Oasis done a reissue of Supersonic as well, I think.
That was one of the biggest and fastest sellers as well.
Yeah.
Stores, so.
Right. Absolutely, that's cool. It's very cool. I mean, I look forward to seeing what happens next year with it as well. And you know, I think, you know, as any big event, there are always going to be kinks as the event scales. And, you know, it's impossible to make an event scale to this size without there being some issues that come along the way. But, you know, it's also a question of, you know, I've read a few pieces about from people that buy records regularly and they go to the record store every week, and you know, a few of them maybe were disappointed with the fact that they had to queue and had to do a number of things, but at the same time it's not really about them, Record Store Day, it's also about people that wouldn't normally go to a record shop, and that, you know, rediscover the pleasure of doing that through Record Store Day, which is a pretty big deal, because the more people we get to go and buy music, the better it is for the whole ecosystem. So that's why, you know, I wanted to talk about this week, and definitely keep up the good work, and look forward to chatting to you next year as well, and see how it all goes. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk about the Wu-Tang Clan's fans Kickstarter, which is kind of a weird story, because the fans of the Wu-Tang Clan decided to start a Kickstarter to try and raise $5 million in order to buy the band's latest record. So the latest record the Wu-Tang Clan is releasing is called Once Upon a Time in Shaolin, and it's a one-off copy, which is not going to be released digitally. It's encased in a silver and nickel box crafted by British Moroccan artist Yahya. I'm sure that I pronounced it wrong. And you know, the Forbes goes on to say, you know, it will probably sell for a lot of money. So the fans decided to start this Kickstarter to raise the money necessary to get the release in the hands of fans and actually distribute it. I mean, the record will tour, apparently will tour festivals and art galleries and centers, and people are going to be able to listen to it for a fee, which is kind of weird. You know, it's talk about trying to reintroduce scarcity in music. You know, they the fans wanted to buy it. You know, of course, the campaign is not doing very well, because there's no... you know, you don't get anything out of it other than the chance of listening to the record, which for a lot of fans is probably not enough to shell enough money to get to the $5 million mark. But you know, for you guys, you know, what do you think about the campaign and the fact that this release got so much press in the last week or so, Stephen?
I think the whole thing sounds crazy to me. You know, I'm not. You know, I think it was all. I hope it's all a joke. You know, the whole Kickstarter thing. I'm not a big fan of Kickstarter campaigns. You know, I've bought into a lot of them in music, and I've been disappointed a few times by some of the Kickstarter campaigns. I think they're not all great, in my opinion. Yeah, I was looking at the money raised by the guys that tried to, you know, fair play to them to try and initiate something, but I think they've got a couple of $100 raised out of the $5 million target.
Yeah.
So they've got a way to go. It just makes no sense to me, this $5 million record thing, you know. It's actually, I find it quite annoying. And I just hope it's all a hoax.
I mean, both,
good PR though.
Yeah, it's good PR. Both things are weird. I mean, both the record itself, which is supposed to be like a one-off piece that is not going to be distributed digitally to anybody else, so that you can only listen to it in person as a sort of an art piece. And also the Kickstarter is weird. So both stories are kind of like oddballs, really. Stuart, do you think that, you know, we're going to see more artists trying really hard to reintroduce a scarcity into the music industry by doing something like this, which is pretty extreme, really?
I don't know. I mean, I kind of like the idea of transient music. It's almost like the Snapchat of music. You hear it once and then you can't do it, and they're apparently going to take your phone off you when you go in to listen to it. You can't, no recording devices allowed, which to think that someone won't get in somehow with a recording device and stick it on BitTorrent the next day is ambitious, I think. I don't know. I mean, it's weird, because it the thing it reminded me of, in a weird way, it's very different, it's the Jay-Z Samsung campaign, where a brand paid loads of money for the album to then give it to people. So it was like it was a corporate person paying for the music, but then distributing it free and opening out to people. So that seems like it's got more go in it than the whole we'll do one thing and one rich person can buy it. And I mean, the other thing is, it's not peak Wu-Tang Clan, is it? God bless them. I mean, you know, they've been pioneers and rightfully kind of acclaimed.
Yeah.
But it's not Wu-Tang Clan at their creative peak years ago. And so you don't know what you're getting. You know, you might go in and it might be like the Offcuts, if like, we can't be asked anymore, here's a, you just don't know. So I mean, I love the idea of it as an event. I love the fact they're kind of going around and playing at museums, and it's kind of making you think about music as art and all those sort of things. So I like that aspect of it, but I wish at the end it wasn't just one person gets it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, hopefully it will be just all a bit of a PR story, and then in the end it will get released digitally.
Yeah, I mean, do you remember that the XX did that thing last year where they leaked the stream of their album to one fan and then watched it spread? And that whole idea of giving it to one person and letting it spread is really exciting. And I kind of wish that had been the thing here. Like, someone gets to keep this beautiful jewel box with the album, the artifact.
Yeah.
But then maybe that person flicks the switch to release it digitally to everyone else.
Yeah.
Like, that would be more exciting, I think.
And the whole thing also, like, it goes back to what Nine Inch Nails did a fair few years ago now, where they purposefully lost a few USB keys in a bathroom of one of their venues, and then those sticks had a few tracks leaked from their latest record, and then they started making the rounds, you know, amongst the fans, and it became a whole viral thing. In a sort of, it was like an interactive campaign. Actually, it was kind of a dystopian future, and it had a whole plot to it. So if you found the stick, you had to sort of start this whole movement. So definitely something that there's something there, and not many artists have managed to take advantage of it, as well as Nine Inch Nails have since that release. But yeah, to just distribute it like this is kind of weird. But we'll see how it goes. And
it's kind of a fun it's a fun time for hip hop though, because you had Jay-Z doing the Samson thing, you had De La Soul giving their entire back catalogue a BitTorrent.
Yeah.
You have I can't what the name is now, but BitTorrent are doing some mixtapey stuff with a bunch of guys from Detroit, I think.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, I've been writing about this stuff for 10 years, and consistently it's been the hip hop guys in the States.
Yeah.
They had new media managers first, digital guys first. They were constantly the first to sort of explore new ideas. And sometimes they are a bit crazy. Like this, sometimes they're like, we have a joke at Music High, Snoop Dogg is always first onto everything new. He was first to sell virtual items. He was first on turntable, you know. Like there's just this smart group of people operating in the US around rappers at the moment who are saying, we're going to try new ways of distribution. So in that sense, it's quite an exciting time. I think the Wu-Tang Clan fits into that, even if it's a bit barking in certain aspects.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of funny that the whole mixtape phenomenon as well, because I'm not really a massive fan of hip hop, but I have downloaded like some of the best mixtapes from last year, for example, and there was some amazing stuff there that has never been released commercially, and it's not on Spotify, it's not on any streaming service, also because of probably sample clearance issues and all sorts of stuff around that. But it's kind of incredible that such a creative space is so underground still, but it's so big, and it's just one of the sort of unseen elephants of the music industry, the fact that there's this whole underbelly of releases that are never seeing the light of day when it comes to streaming services, whilst you're seeing millions of crappy cover versions or crappy karaoke versions flooding them at the same time. So it'd be nice if we could find ways to monetize those effectively and clear the samples a little bit more easily. But, you know, that's the industry we're in. And talking about Pandora story, I wanted to pick up from what we talked about last week with Deborah Newman from New York, and there was a development actually late last week, as the major labels together with ABCO and the RIAA have filed a suit in the US against Pandora on the issue of pre-1972 recordings. So the Copyright Act protects the master recordings post-1972 on a federal level, but not the pre-1972 ones. So it's a slightly complicated issue, but essentially what happens is that a service like Pandora so far has only paid Sound Exchange, which is the performing rights society that's collecting the revenues for the performance of those master recordings for post 1972 recordings, and all the ones before that are not receiving a penny right now on the master front. And so of course the labels are up in arms about it, and they believe that even though they're not protected on a federal level, they should be protected on a state law level, and are filing a suit in order to prove just that. And apparently there's tens of millions of dollars on the table of royalties each year that are not paid out. There's a big debate right now going on various sites as to whether this is another case of the labels trying to crush Pandora, whether it's another case of, you know, the law just being completely unreasonable in the way that it's structured, and so it being just kind of weird that people before a certain date in 1972 can get paid and the ones before can't. And so, you know, it's just a big headache right now when it comes to internet radio services in the US. Stephen, from your end, you know, from a Shuffler fan perspective, how do you feel about all this? And do you think that the labels should cut Pandora some slack at this point?
It's a tough one. You know, like Pandora, they seem to be brilliant at upsetting people in the music industry. You know, I was reading a story yesterday, I think it was Buddy Holly's widow.
Right.
And like, she's extremely upset. She's been upset saying that they're not getting remunerated because it's pre-72. And I was listening to Stuart this morning, and they were like, all the Beatles stuff is pre-72. And,
right.
You know, it's a real mess. It's a real mess. You know, Pandora is hugely popular. You know, they've got massive amounts of users and it's a great service. But, you know, the labels just are not happy with, you know, with the money that they're getting back. And I don't know how much slack they can cut them, because artists need to get compensated fairly. And,
yeah.
And you know, Pandora are upsetting so many people, you know. I wish there was a, there's no easy answer. It's a bit of a nightmare, but
it is a bit of a nightmare, you know, yeah.
It's a bit sad.
It's a kind of legislative nightmare that is a nightmare both for the labels and for Pandora, because it's so expensive also on the legal front to fight and find a middle ground on this. So, Stuart, from a Pandora perspective, do you think that this is, people are going to be too hard on Pandora right now? Or is it just the nature of this hodgepodge of legislations that needs to be sorted out at some point or another? And so kind of a confrontation in court is at this point inevitable.
Yeah, well, I mean, they have got the full house now, haven't they? They've got publishers sort of bitching at them, they've got labels bitching them, they've got artists and songwriters unhappy. And I think it's a weird one. On one hand, this taps into this really unpleasant sort of backstory in the music industry, which is of music companies saying tech companies have built businesses based on our material and they're not compensating us enough. And with Pandora, they can't take licenses away from them because it's a blanket license. So they can't exert the kind of pressure they would normally do.
I think
in this case, it's not Pandora is bad. It's is the copyright laws right and working. You know, Pandora's doing nothing wrong by not paying these royalties because the law seemingly says it doesn't have to. And this court case, I mean, this and SiriusXM as well, is the satellite radio case. So they were sued first, I think, by the labels, and that case is going through. So the cases will prove, well, you do have to pay royalties and Ringo Starr can have another jumbo liner. but it is. I mean, I think it's one of those things where it is. I mean, like Buddy Holly's widow is out speaking this weekend, saying, you know, there is a bunch of musicians and their dependents and their families who made brilliant music before those years and aren't sitting there now with kind of mounds of money.
Yeah.
So there is quite an emotional aspect to this that people. On the other hand, this is slightly. I don't want to paint everyone with the same brush, but if you were to talk to artists pre-1972 about who they've been exploited by, it's not just by digital services now. No. You know, there were some dodgy label deals in those days and songwriting deals. You know, the music industry has a history of exploiting people. So I think for labels to kind of say those poor artists in those days, they're not getting the money they deserve, it's a little bit, it leaves them open, I think, to people saying, hang on a minute, you know, are you paying them fairly for stuff? So it's a can of worms inside a nest of hornets, this stuff.
Absolutely.
But I think it should come down to not is Pandora bad or wrong. It should come down to is the copyright laws fair, and if not, how do they need to be? And then people at Pandora will then they'll know where they stand.
Yeah.
I think that's what the other thing is. Pandora do lobby. I think they're lobbying to bring down their royalty commitments. You know, I think they're probably lobbying to keep this loophole in, you know. So it's not just, I think there's a lot of bad blood on both sides from a variety of things. And then, so that's where when this comes out, it becomes Pandora against the music companies. And it's very bad tempered. Although I understand it, I'm disappointed because Pandora is one of the most successful things we have in terms of building scale and getting people to kind of listen and pay. So I wish there was less rancor in it.
Yeah, I wish, you know, it is like a business story, really. And, you know, there's a lot of emotions that are put into these stories when it comes to, like, you know, is the music industry trying to crush Pandora or is Pandora stealing money from the music industry? And at the end of the day, it's just a question of business and money and, you know, the emotions that are running high, of course, because it involves artists, are kind of hard to control. And I mean, I guess one of the interesting issues around this is because Sound Exchange actually pays artists directly, is a percentage of the money they get goes directly to the artist instead of going via the record label. So I guess that's maybe where it becomes much more emotional for the artist, because of course they've been ripped off on their contracts pre-1972 anyway, because I doubt they're getting a lot of royalties through those. And you know, the idea of being able to claim X amount from Sound Exchange that goes directly to them or to their relatives, then that's a pretty interesting new form of income for them that they haven't seen before. So I think on that front, it's definitely something that artists pre-1972 would be interested in getting. Of course, the labels want to get their own share, and that's why they filed the lawsuit. So we'll see how that shakes out. And I want to talk about live. So we've seen an interesting development at Rock in Rio today. Rock in Rio US announced a couple of new details on what's going to happen in Las Vegas next May in 2015. The festival has a new venue that is going to get built right on the Strip, which sounds amazing, which is going to hold up to 80,000 people, and it will be paid for by MGM, Cirque du Soleil, and Ucapia. The three companies will own the venue and presumably use it for a variety of other shows throughout the year, but Rock in Rio is booked in there for 2015, 2017, and 2019. Rock in Rio is set to create a very premium festival experience with amusement parks on site, a flying DJ booth, and actually real toilets, which is amazing for a music festival. And there's no word on a lineup or pricing yet, and tickets go on sale in January 2015. The festival is also doing a big push on American media, of course, to try and get a bit more recognition, because you know, Rock in Rio is a well-known name for music fans, especially if you're looking up stuff on YouTube. You know, it will come up with some amazing performances through the years, but on a mainstream level, it may not be as well known a festival, so definitely some work to be done on there. And through the SFX Entertainment Partnership, we can expect to see a lot of electronic music as well being part of the festival and being incorporated, as well as the usual rock and pop mix that Rock in Rio is well known for. So, Stephen, are you excited about this new festival? And would you make the trip and try and experience a big time music festival in Vegas?
I'd much prefer to go to Rio, Rock in Rio. You know, you know, the concept of Rock in Rio in Vegas, to me, not so appealing, but it makes, you know, these guys, they've probably done the numbers. You know, someone like MGM and Cirque du Soleil, they've got it all worked out. They know the occupancy rates. They know, they have it all figured out, and they know who they're putting, you know, with the SFX partnership, who they're going to have headline next year. They've thought all this out. These guys are forensic, you know, but
they're all building companies, right?
Lots of people are like Vegas, but is a South by are doing a kind of a satellite event in Vegas as well. Yeah. You know, it's just seems like an excuse to fill hotel rooms in Vegas, you know, which, you know, fair play to the guys in the Nevada State Gambling Commission or whoever it is lobbying to get Rock in Rio in there. Yeah, no doubt it will be a success, but not for me.
Yeah. And Stuart, for you, do you see any, you know, could this be an interesting intersection of a variety of different entertainment forms, and maybe we can see something new come up here rather than the usual music festival?
Maybe, but flying DJ booth, what have we become? It's basically Tommy Lee and his flying drum kit all over again for the EDM engineers. Yeah. I don't know. I mean Vegas, because Vegas already has this big line going in dance music stuff, hasn't it? They have big yeah. raves there, and it's become a big part of the thing. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's. I saw a presentation. Was it Amidem? The guy from Rock in Rio did a presentation, an interview, talking about how they're expanding and going everywhere. And they're obviously an interesting organization. They're thinking hard about where to go and why.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, I think I agree with Stephen. I'd rather go to Rio. I'd rather go to Rio and see the proper carnival than go to Rock in Rio, because I think it's this big rock bands playing a big gig, and it's an amazing thing. But I'd more rather go to Rio and see the kind of the Brazilian thing. It doesn't happen over here.
Yeah.
But no, I mean
the only thing that appeals to me is that you can go to a festival and actually go back to your very nice hotel room in Vegas after that.
And then gamble it all away.
Instead of having to go into a tent, which is definitely appealing. But
I'm wondering, will it damage the brand? You know, is there any chance that, you know, like some of these partnerships or some of these, you know, guys that have done things great forever, you know, when you change, you know, sometimes it's not Rock in Rio. Sometimes it's successful, you know, like the Tour de France, you know, to take sports and cycling, you know, they've done Tour de France all around Europe, you know, in Ireland and London and in different cities, so it's worked for those guys. But I was at a conference, you know, not a conference, I was at a talk yesterday, and one of the guys from the founder of Fabric Nightclub, you know, he was talking about, you know, once you start selling out or doing some of these things, you're not what you were at the beginning, and you've lost a lot of authenticity, and you know, it's a whole different mindset. It's not what you set out to be. And, you know, the guys at Fabric, you know, just, you know, one of the great clubs, you know, the last 20 years probably. And, you know, they've turned down so many of these opportunities to do things all around the world. And he said he sleeps easy at night because of that, you know?
Yeah. It's two different models, right? You know, a Ministry of Sound model, which is, you know, taking it all over the world. And working like that, and the other side of things where you try and keep it contained and keep it true to the sort of the original nature of the project, but both valid, both with their own merits. And but yeah, I'm excited to see what's going to happen with it. It's definitely going to be something they're going to experiment with, because they don't have that much brand presence in the US yet, and so definitely they're going to have to try some interesting stuff in the run up to it. So I'll keep an eye on it and see.
They could do a Freddie Mercury hologram performance. God, you know, no. From was it 82 that had Queen on Rock and Rio?
Yeah, that's an amazing performance.
Well, that's it in my head, because Rock and Rio, I think, did Guns N' Roses play there once as well to an enormous crowd? That's in my head, is Rock and Rio, is like stupidly enormous crowds watching rock bands play. And it'd be interesting to see how that goes. But I mean, I think it's one of those things where now, more so than ever before, festival bands are global things. Like Glastonbury is known around the world, it attracts people from everywhere.
Yeah.
We know about, I mean, in Europe, we kind of, people sit down and go, I might go to Croatia for a festival this year. I might go to Primavera in Barcelona. Like, and maybe I'll go to Vegas and see them. So I think these brands are becoming global. And they are all thinking, well, what can we do and where can we do it? And how can we draw people in? So yeah, but like Stephen says, like the fact that Rock in Rio is a brand, and it sounds like it maybe won't describe this new event quite so aptly. Maybe they could spin off a new brand and create something new. You know, it'd be interesting to see how it goes. Like Rock in Rio with a flying DJ booth sounds like an intrinsically strange thing, but but you know, good luck to them.
Yeah, exactly. And it's SFX is definitely pushing hard for that, I'm sure. And we're gonna have to close fairly soon, but I just wanted to cover a couple of quick things. So first of all, Samsung has revealed that the Milk Music app has been downloaded 380,000 times since its launch in the US. So that's a significant number, although it's not a scratch yet on Pandora's numbers or even Songza's numbers, really. And the company has accidentally revealed its plans to actually start charging for the Milk Music app, which is a departure from the fact that it was supposed to be completely free for everybody and advertising free as well for Samsung owners, Samsung device owners. And now they're going to charge us somewhere in the region of $3.99 per month, which is, it's Pandora's old price point. Pandora is jacking up the prices as of next month to $4.99, I believe. We talked about Milk last week on the show in the context of Samsung's partnership with Deezer in Europe. But what do you guys make of the number and the potential number of users that might actually take up the premium option on what's really like, it's actually just a branding exercise on Samsung's part. I mean, let's not be kidding around here. We're not talking about a real service because it's all based on Slacker Radio. It's actually, very much a branding exercise. Stuart, what are your thoughts on that?
I'm kind of intrigued by Samsung because, I mean, in terms of selling phones, and to listen to tablets, they're really successful. They're selling lots more than Apple and everyone else. But in terms of music, it's been a bit... First they bought M-Spot, that cloud company, and they made their own Samsung Music Hub, which didn't do that well. Now they've got a deal with Deezer in Europe to do bundling stuff. They're doing this Milk thing themselves in the States. They seem to be very much... They're going back out to sort of... Whereas Apple's in, we do everything ourselves.
Yeah.
Samsung's be going back out saying, we'll get partners like Deezer in and we'll get Slacker Radio in. And so I'm fascinated to see why they haven't really had success with the music strategy so far.
Yeah.
I mean, Milk it seems to tie into that thing people were saying of actually most people want music to play to them. They don't want to go and choose stuff. They want to have radio-like things. So it makes sense to have that within devices. Because it's not over here yet, we haven't been able to play with it. I mean, I'm like Beats, we're waiting for it to kind of launch in the UK so we can have a good old... explore and see how it compares.
Exactly, and also you would have to have a Samsung phone to be able to try it out, so that's another problem. Right there. But yeah, it's kind of weird that an app that you can only access through certain phones anyway, that's a branding exercise for the brand. You then start charging for or try to convert people to a premium tier. I don't know. Stephen, do you think that Samsung can challenge Pandora's domain in this, and why would they want to do that? Why don't they just keep it free and take the hit on the money? I mean, it's not going to be that much anyway.
Yeah, I agree with you, Andre. I don't think they can challenge. I think, they can get a lot of people to download the app because, they can push that app to the front of or bundle it in with lots of phones. So distribution and downloads isn't a problem. Like, I'm not surprised by the 380,000. Like, it's going to be, a tiny amount that those people will pay.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why they're doing it, it's not so interesting to me, I think they're doing some smarter partnerships in Europe. Like the stuff with Deezer is pretty good. Deezer is a rock solid service. It works really well. They can get a lot of people to download Deezer here in Europe. That makes no sense to me to they're not even going to make a lot of money, are they? If say 10% of that, 10% of 380,000 people download it, at the very maximum, it's not a huge amount of money when you factor everything into it.
And I mean, at that point,
Milk compares to what Nokia has done with mixed radio. Interesting, like you get the phone, it's free, and you get this thing playing your radio channels, and then you can subscribe for a more premium experience. And Nokia's never given out any figures for mixed radio. We're not sure what Microsoft are going to do with it once they buy Nokia, because they have their own thing. But it's interesting to see Samsung basically following Nokia's template in a way there.
I mean, I guess the one thing I just thought right now is that Slacker is not just a radio service. So Slacker's got three or four different tiers. And you can go all the way from, a free radio service all the way to an actual premium on-demand streaming service, which is their $9.99 a month offering, which not that many people know about. But Slacker do have that option. You can actually subscribe as a full-fledged streaming service. So whether some of the premium stuff that Samsung plans to offer is going to integrate some of those parts of Slacker as well and offer a more sort of on-demand experience, we don't know, but that could be interesting.
It could be interesting. That's probably what they're going to do, actually.
Yeah, there might be that, because I mean, it would make sense considering the Visa partnership here in Europe. But yeah, that could be interesting. But again, that would have to be it would be confusing to the consumer, because they started with the milk service as being an internet radio service, and if they converted it into a premium on-demand service, then that would make it a very difficult thing to explain. So yeah, lots of question marks on that. And a couple of things to finish with that I just mentioned without commenting on, because we haven't got time, but Sony Music has struck a partnership with the Zee Music company in India to license the radio, digital and physical rights of the music of 7 high-profile Bollywood movies, which should push it to becoming the leader in the Bollywood market in India, 35% according to Business Standard. And the music startup Beat Robo got a $1.1 million fundraise from a chain, actually from a Japanese store chain called Lawson, and this is going to go towards developing the Plug Air device, which aims to be the mixtape of the future. So it's a little device that plugs into the headphone jack of a device of a phone, and it acts as a key for instantly downloading music and playlists. So it's an interesting play here. I'm not sure how it's going to pan out, but I don't know. You guys think that there is a... the Japanese market is weird because they're still trying to manage this transition to digital from physical. Do you think that a little hardware device that mimics the function of a CD to just download tracks can gain traction somewhere that, where the industry is such a weird flux?
Only in Japan.
In Japan, right?
might be brilliant in Japan.
Yeah, I'm gonna try and get the guys on a call and see what they're working on. But it's definitely, it doesn't sound like something that would ever work here in the UK or in the US. So it's a very niche product. But Lawson has got 10,000 outlets in Japan. Wow. So if they manage to get it out there, then it could become a bridge between the physical and digital spaces in the Japanese music industry. So it's definitely one to keep an eye on. And finally, I just wanted to ask you what you guys are up to, if you want to plug anything. Stuart, anything you want to plug, either an article you've just finished or something that you're working on, anything at all.
Oh, right. Okay. I should be going. Well, actually, at Music Ally, so we've got a post-Easter treat we're doing at the moment. We're trying to give people 2 months free trial to our newsletter and our reports, because we realise that people who get Musical.ly love it, and quite a few people out there still think of us as that blog that writes about digital music, and they don't realise we have this pay service. So if anyone goes to musical.ly.com, there's banners to get this 2 months free trial with no strings. You don't put credit card details in, we're not going to hassle you at the end. It's just like 2 months of it. If you like it at the end, then you can decide if you want to subscribe. So yeah, come to the site and have a look.
And I thoroughly recommend that as well. And Stephen, on your front, what's going on Shuffler? Anything you want to loop us in with?
Good timing today. We a couple of months ago, we launched an app called Pause in the iTunes App Store.
Yeah.
Initially, it was so the first edition we put out in February, been pretty well received, got a lot of love from lots of folks. We just launched the second edition of Pause, so we're kind of doubling.
Awesome.
It's going to be available from the iTunes App Store, now available for iPhone. So we're kind of doubling down. Shuffler is known for curation and This version is it's a quarterly curated magazine highlighting the best of the music web. We've got some great articles in there, great websites, great editorial, tastemakers, and it's free. Check it out on iPhone and iPad.
That's awesome.
Please.
That's awesome. And so this,
I tell you what, I'll plug your product too, because I love the idea. This idea, there's so much music whizzing past our noses and so many blogger posts and that. I love the idea of something that says, you know what, we're going to do a quarterly thing and just round up the best stuff and you can sit and read it in one go. But it's a really nice idea, because I think we're all being overloaded with stuff constantly all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I like that.
He described it better than me.
My fees for being your marketing consultant are low.
Yeah, there's a couple of magazines that I follow, like that are free, I think. There's Ox. There's also like the CBC Music Canada is quite a good resource for music too. But a pause on a quarterly basis is a must have for anybody that listens to the show. So go and get it right now if you haven't.
Thanks, guys.
Already. And well, guys, it was a real pleasure to have you on the show. And thanks so much for coming on once again. And thanks so much for listening as well. You can find out everything on digitalmusictrends.com. I also do weekly interviews with the startups and interesting digital music projects. So you can check those out if you go to digitalmusictrends.com and follow through the links to the one-to-one show. And all the interviews are there. It's about 56 shows to date. And if you want to get in touch, again, tweet us on @DigiMusicTrends or email contact@digitalmusictrends.com. Have a fantastic week, and until next time.